I'm John. I'm an alcoholic. And even though we don't usually do this, I'm actually John Looney. That is my given last name. It played a part in my story, at least I like to think it did. To start off, my sober date is August 18, 2012. It's been about 2,003 days since that day without a drink. So that's the second longest I've gone in my life without a drink. Before that, it was the first 12 years of my life. My family, we were an absolute alcohol-free household. I didn't learn my drinking from anyone. I figured it all out on my own. It is of my own making. I wonder sometimes if I had known what alcohol had done to my family, would I have still drank the way that I did drink? I had family members that were closet alcoholics. I had family members that died before I was born. They died of, alcohol-related diseases at an early age, so I didn't get to meet them. I saw pictures of one that I was the spitting image of, and he died at 55 of a heart attack. And I mean, literally, when I was about 14, 15 years old, I had my hair in a ponytail, and I found a picture of this guy I'd never seen before, and it's my dad's uncle. I held it up and looked in the mirror, and there's a picture of John right there. And, this guy, he went off to World War II. He came back. He was a changed man. He drank himself out of a number of high-paying jobs. He drank himself out of a marriage, and he died at 55 of a heart attack. Alcohol-related, he died in some other city somewhere in a hotel room, real glorious. So we never talked about that kind of stuff in my family. We didn't talk about those things like that. My papa, who is my mom's dad, once again, we didn't talk about his alcoholism. He didn't talk about the fact that this shit runs in our family. And I'm going to pause for a second. Some spicy language, I guess. It's in my vocabulary. If I offend anyone, I apologize. It jumps out. If anybody wants to take a tally and punch me in the stomach for every time I drop the F-bomb, you're welcome. I'll try to keep it clean, keep it G-rated. But I never really heard about what my papaw did. I would catch hints every now and then about, papaw's a drinker. He used to drink a lot. He grew up down in South Georgia, moonshining. There was a lot of moonshining going on down there. He was my idol, though. He was the smartest man I ever knew. He was a school bus driver at 16. He was completely self-educated, but he could tell you something about everything. He knew a little something about anything you could ask him about. I never bothered to ask him, what is alcoholism? I did know that, when he was 10 years old, there was a really bad flu epidemic hitting the world that was wiping out, large portions of the population. His grandma gave him a tablespoon of moonshine, put him down for 3 days. He woke up feeling like $1 million. So at that, I was probably about 10 when I heard that, and I was like, oh, so apparently alcohol might be bad, but it's not too bad. It was 12 years old when I finally got the opportunity to prove myself a drinker. I still remember hanging out with my sister, her boyfriend, and he had a friend that was old enough to buy some alcohol. We all went down to the river, and his buddy stopped off and grabbed a 40 Budweiser. Oh, yeah. We go down to the river, and I realize in hindsight, his buddy was the wingman to distract the younger brother so that they could have some alone time. Did not realize that at 12. All I knew is that this guy had beer. I wasn't supposed to drink that for some reason. I knew it probably wouldn't kill me because I knew people that had drank. And I'm curious, what is this going to do? So he pops the bottle open. He's like, well, you go ahead. It's your first time. I take a swig. It didn't kill me. I start chugging it. He says, no, that's my beer, man. And I was like, okay. Can I have one more sip? And I start walking off with it. He's like, no. Okay. So I wound up chugging about a third of a 40 for my first drink. We rode around for a little while after that. Nothing happened. The world didn't explode. There was, there was no great flood. No biblical plagues came down. It didn't really seem to do that much. I felt a little groggy, a little giggly, but I thought it was cool. I was hanging out with the older kids, and I was, I'm becoming a man now. All right, but alcohol was still out of reach for me. The only people that I knew that actually drank openly was I had a friend whose dad may or may not qualify for our little club here. He would have noticed had I stolen any of his beer. I assure you that. I know he enjoyed it well enough that he took stock. And he had a couple of boys in the house that he was wise to keep an inventory of that. It was roughly about age 13 when I got my first opportunity with some hard liquor. And that was my first blackout, too. The first opportunity I had to drink hard liquor, I drank until there was no more there. And nothing too bad happened. I'm a little bit embarrassed. My cousin was telling me about what was going on the night before. Once again, the world didn't explode. I didn't die. That's a big key for me. I was now intrigued because there were things that happened. There were things that I did. My body performed actions, and my brain doesn't remember them. And, I enjoyed at this time. I had a sister that was in college, and I used to like to grab her textbooks and just kind of thumb through them trying to make myself smart. And she had a lot of psychology textbooks for a class she was taking, and I got really intrigued by that. And I was really intrigued by the idea, like, is that my subconscious trying to come out, and it's trying to it's trying to manifest itself. Like, maybe that's who I really am. Maybe that part of my brain that keeps me functioning in a blackout, maybe that's the real John. That was an insane thought. I look back now, and I was too naive at the time to realize, like, no, you're just an average alcoholic, bud. Welcome to the club. So at age 14, I remember one day my family was a very church-going family. My dad, he literally did not miss a single day of Sunday school from the age of 14 to age 62, did not miss a single day of Sunday school. He was a deacon, he was a teacher. I used to help him study to teach his classes. And one day I was sitting in church, and I had a habit of listening to the first little bit of the sermon, and the preacher would kind of ramble on about whatever he was rambling on, and I wanted to just study. I had a reference Bible, and I would just go through and just see where the Spirit would take me. I had a connection with God, but it wasn't in those parameters that everybody, I just didn't feel that. I felt different, and I felt like I should act differently. And there was, I still don't remember the scripture, but I know it was in Proverbs, and I'm not a Bible thumper, but I will say if you're into spirituality and you never read anything in the Bible, Proverbs is a good one. It does not, in my opinion, it doesn't matter where you come from. There's a lot to be taken out of that book, but or at least for me, there was. That's one that's still a go-to for me, and I came across a scripture that made an idea pop up in my head that there's three types of smarts in this world. You got intelligent people that, they can figure out puzzles and stuff like that. And that's cool. You need those people in the world. They are of the utmost importance. You've got knowledgeable people. It's people that dig into books and they read stuff and they just know all this stuff and help teach other people. And that's incredibly important, too. And you got wise people who go out and try and taste and know from experience. That's what I wanted to be. I remember saying a prayer in church one day, God, make me wise. And that was the stupidest thing I ever did. If I could go back now, I would just read the book, buy the shirt, and tell everybody I did it. But it's que sera, we will not regret the past. So at 14, I decided I was going to start trying and tasting more things. I still couldn't get my hands on liquor. Because, it's regulated, it's a little bit harder to get a hold of than what, say, some good weed. And, I had friends with, they had psychological issues that had pills. I had a, One buddy in particular, Fug Ugly Doug, we used to mess with him a lot, but he's a good friend, and he really was a brother, and he kind of felt bad for what he did in hindsight, but he used to give us his Dexedrines, which, if you're not familiar, it's basically like the 1990s version of Adderall. It's amphetamines. And one day after school, we thought we came up with a really good idea. Had a buddy lived by the school, and Doug lived right kind of close to him. We were going to walk over to Buddy's house, go over to someone else's house and get some liquor. We're going to run over to Doug's house, we're going to get some pills. And then we can hitch a ride over to the soccer fields near my house when my buddy has a soccer game. It's the perfect crime. I'll make it home before Mom even gets home from work. Bada bing, bada boom. This is going to be beautiful. So we go and knock on this girl's door. Parents aren't home. Like, hey, we need to get into your parents' liquor cabinet. And I was amazed. I had never seen so much liquor in one place in my life. And so we grab some Dixie cups, and I fill mine entirely up. And she's like, you can't take it all out of one bottle. So we mixed it all up. All kinds of mixed liquor. Yeah, it's a party, people. Come on. And so we fill that Dixie cup up. And my buddy fills his about halfway up and fills it the rest of the way up with some kind of mixer because he's was. But so I don't know how to drink this stuff. I take a sip. I'm like, that tastes awful, just awful. I'm not going to try to taste that for any longer than I have to. So I slam it. And my buddy, who had drank hard liquor before and he was used to the way it felt and he knew what it would do to him, he was smart enough to not do what I just did. And so he hands me his, and I slam that one too. Now it's time to go get the speed. All right, so we go over to my friend's house, and I don't remember how many of those pills I took. I was told it was somewhere in the ballpark of 9. We had been taking them every day at school, one or two after lunch, you know, just a little something to make the day interesting in 8th grade. Off to a good start, man. Hit the gates running, man. That's it. But I don't remember much about that day. I do remember kind of came to, and I was in this place that was really dark, but it was incredibly peaceful. There's no noise. It was kind of like right before you fall asleep. I was kind of floating a little bit. And then he's back. We got him back. And there's a room full of nurses around me. And I don't know what the hell's going on. It happened again that night. And the next day, my family's in the hospital room. And everybody's crying. I've got tubes in places that I don't ever want to have tubes again. I haven't since that day, knock on wood, but will. Got electrodes all over me and things and beeps and all this kind of stuff. And they explained to me that my heart stopped 3 times the night before. And they need to know where I got the drugs. And I knew exactly where I got the drugs, but I wasn't about to tell them because, you know, that would fuck up my supply. I'm going to do that. So, the truth came out. Somebody ratted on us. We get told by the nice judge, we didn't officially get arrested, but we did go to court. And I got told by a judge that I was going to have to go to classes. Okay, so I go to classes. I didn't really learn anything. I did learn a little bit about how to metabolize alcohol faster, so I do appreciate that for them. I had a couple other little run-ins. That's another really good one, was the night that we went and borrowed somebody's car. He left the keys in it. Oh, yeah, there was alcohol involved in that, too. Bottom shelf liquor. What do you know? It's kind of a running theme in my life. I mean, the good times was before I turned 21. That was, you know, we had the summer when I was 16. Had a gas station start selling me alcohol because I had like a little bit of fuzz on my lip and I was at least this tall. So that was a fun summer. You know, we would go get Mad Dog 2020 and we would just get ham-dammered off that and sit in my bedroom after Mom went to bed. We'd just sit in the bedroom and see how much we could drink before we puked in the bucket. And it was a lot of fun. That's what normal kids do, right? That's what you do. And, we were living sex, drugs, and rock and roll at 16, and it was a party and it was great. The problem is that didn't really translate to good, like, grades in school for John. I discovered in high school that I'm actually really good at algebra after about 6 shots of vodka. I don't know how that works. Just gotta get right, you know. But I use those type of things as an excuse. My brain is different, you know. I've always been unique, I felt, and that almost killed me. It was about a month before I turned 21. I had drank away some girlfriend that I was just so in love with, and I was learning to live as an adult at this time. I had lost my mom, and to back up for a moment, because I can't leave this out. My mother was diagnosed with ALS at age 7 when I was 17. She was 54. She had been showing symptoms of that for about 2.5 years. And back in the mid to late 90s, there was not a long prognosis for people with ALS. It's come a long way. You know, it's Lou Gehrig's disease. It's an awful, awful disease that I wouldn't wish on my worst enemy. But both of my older sisters at this point had moved out to start their lives. And that left little John being the primary caregiver. And I was trying to go to school. And this is one of those funny times in my life that I felt it then, and I know it now. I got caught with a joint at school. And the way I got caught is ridiculous. It's one of those things where, like, God basically took that joint out of my pocket and handed it to a teacher. I'm not going to get into the full story because we've all got some really cool stories about getting busted. But what I do know is that God needed me somewhere else at the time. He needed me to take care of my mother. So I learned to do that. I learned to take care of her. And after she passed, that was one of the few times in my life that I actually successfully quit drinking for any period of time. 2 days after she had passed, I had friends coming by with bottles of booze in both hands, bags of weed. Let's get those feelings numbed out. And I said, nope, that'll make me an alcoholic. I'm not going to do that. I know what that turns you into, an addict. I'm psychology. I know stuff. I read things. So I knew that I was on the right track to not ever have to take any more classes. I'd learned enough. And at age 20, right before I turned 21, this morning some chick, I talked a friend of mine into buying me a bottle of vodka. I'd just gotten a new car, and I was feeling real emotional. And I pulled an M&M and drank that fifth of vodka. And I started cruising. I'd worked a third shift the night before and hadn't been to sleep in about 30-some-odd hours. And that's not really a good combination with, you know, hard liquor and immaturity, hormones. And I blacked out somewhere. There's some road work going on. Go off the side of the road, crashed that car and kind of folded it in half and came out with a black eye. Once again, you know, I feel that God has had his hand on me since I was a small child. Like, there's a little bit of uniqueness in everyone. God's got some kind of purpose that I'm still trying to figure out. We'll get into that. But I should have died numerous times. And there's a couple other near-death experiences in there that that we all have. I know that this room would not be so packed if this wasn't a life or death issue. You know, if we all didn't have our asses on fire with a gun to our head, we wouldn't have come in here, you know. And I know for me, it was never the alcohol for me. There was always some other thing. It was always, you know, it was those pills, or, you know, I was hanging out with the wrong people, or I was heartbroken, or maybe I should have checked the alignment. I don't know. Whatever it was, the liquor was just an innocent bystander, and it shouldn't be blamed for anything. I need to keep that around. It's going to be okay. But, you know, I quit drinking for about, you know, I told everybody I'm done drinking for good after I folded that car in half. And I made it on sheer will for about 9 months. And I was doing really good. Then holiday season hit, and I got to thinking about Mom. That was my excuse. which, I mean, I don't know about y'all, but I'm good at coming up with excuses. I can rattle them off when the time suits me, when the need suits me. But I kept on going with that cycle of, I drink way too much. I know I do. I will continue drinking way too much until I hit some wall. I will quit, and every time I quit, the increment of time would get a little bit shorter. And finally, I just quit quitting, because quitting's for quitters. And I had worked at a job. I'd worked at Kroger's for, you know, I went in as a bagger. I found out that I could use like half my brain and make a paycheck. I could work a budget pretty good, so I didn't need a whole lot of money to get by. I could, you know, I had big boy bills to pay at this time because I'd taken over the house payment and had family living there. And I felt like an adult. I felt like I was doing everything I needed to do. I kept food in the fridge. I kept the lights on. I kept the roof over our head. And if anybody had any problems with my actions, they can get out. I don't care. And you know, I'm a man. You can't tell me what to do. And it took until about 2008, and my family had had enough. They found somewhere else to live. And, you know, the sister had moved back in to take care of me. I wound up taking care of her, and she realized there's nothing that she could do to help me. So she left, and now the party starts. I went through another... I fell on another woman like a tree, which is basically how it happens with alcoholics, I found. I watch and see that they get within range and we're on them. And that's just what happens, man. And everything, you know, typically nothing, until an alcoholic is able to recover some bit of stability and sanity into his life again, keep your distance. My opinion. But, you know, I saw myself, and I say I saw myself because at this point I started to feel less and less in control of my actions. I started to have this this necessity to drink. I'd been diagnosed with insomnia after, you know, the run-in when I was 14. Went and saw a shrink, and he says, you have depression and insomnia. Here's some zombie pills. I didn't like those zombie pills. I prefer the other ones I can get. I prefer the other things I can do out here. You know, So I tossed that away. But when I got old enough to buy my own liquor, I could get to sleep. I thought I was sleeping. I was passing out, you know. And I turned one woman's life upside down. And I hope she got away from me before I had any impact on her child. And I've spoken to her since then as part of what we have to do to stay sober in here. And she assures me no permanent harm done. And, you know, so that is some relief for me. After she left me, and after I'd gotten drunk enough and come in drunk at Kroger's enough times, they told me they were going to fire me, and I asked them just to give me a chance. I'm going to try AA. I hear it works for people. So I came into AA. I came into my first meeting. I can't tell you the date. I know it was shortly before Christmas in 2008. And the first night, I walked into a speaker's meeting, and I sat down, and there was a guy, Robert A., from Rockmart, was speaking up at the Surf Club. And I was thankful because I was worried I was going to have to share anything about myself. And as it turns out, we don't always have to do that here. If you don't feel comfortable with something, you don't have to do it. I didn't know that then. I thought there were like requirements and like you got to sign like a waiver or something. I had all these expectations. That's what we do. And I go into this meeting and I felt sort of comfortable. It was odd. First thing that struck me was that, you know, I'd talk about that last name Looney. That's something that I've always taken a very strong pride in my Irish heritage because I've had to deal with the last name Looney my whole life. when I was a kid, it was all Looney Tunes, and When I was about 14 or so, my sister at college, she does some research on the name, finds out it's Irish, and it means warrior, which is not something you want to tell a 14-year-old boy with freaking hormones running through puberty stuff going on. Like, Looney Tunes, what kind of a name is that? It's Irish. How you like me now, huh? So it just turned to Looney. That's what everybody, people from back in the day, they see me, Looney, what's up? And other people that don't know me from back in the day are like, people really call you? You're both sick. People say that, okay. But, that Irish heritage, I'd always read books about Irish customs and Irish folklore and things like that. And there was this one little thing I had, it was like a drinking book, basically. And it's full of Irish blessings and prayers and toasts and Irish sayings. And it had the Serenity Prayer in it, as if it was an Irish prayer. No kidding. Which, I mean, most Irish people that really take a strong love of their Irish heritage probably will wind up saying that prayer at some point in time. But when I came in and that was the first thing they did, I was like, holy crap, there might be something to this. There might be something here for me to actually listen and not hate. So I gave it a chance. I was like, I'll give this a chance. And at the end of that meeting, they had a little raffle. Somebody won a big book. And she walks over and she hands it to me. I'm like, cool, I like to read. This works out. So I went home that night and I started reading. I crack open my beer. And because I'm trying to sober up, it's just beer. And I read the first 164 that night. I hadn't had a book grab a hold of me like that in a long time. The older I get, the more I become sort of ADD. I got some attention issues. Y'all probably noticed me jumping around a bit tonight. But I read that first 164, and it was like an unauthorized autobiography. That was me, you know. The two wives, that chapter made me realize what I was doing to this woman and her child, and what a piece of shit I was. And I started trying to sober up. And I made it 2 months, and I was still suspended from Kroger's. I hadn't officially been fired. I had that hanging over my head. I had this fear. I had talked to someone. I was going to make him my sponsor. And I was going to have him, I had a plan. I was going to have him work me through the steps. I still remember the reason I chose him is because he said a quote from Khalil Gibran, and I can't remember the exact quote. I just remember being impressed because I remembered Khalil Gibran, and I was drunk as hell when I read that book. But he took me into one of the back rooms there, and we start talking about the steps, and he says, let's talk about these steps, okay? You powerless over alcohol? I'm like, most of the time. Are you powerless over alcohol? And we start to analyze how well I was at controlling alcohol. I'll play. Maybe I am powerless over alcohol. Is your life unmanageable? No. I mean, all things considered, I might drink, you know, and yeah, I get fucked up on the weekend, turn it out, woo. But, you know, I get the bills paid. I mean, I never went without food. I've always been responsible. He's like, how's your job going right now? I'm like, well, if they take me back, then when I start back, you know. He's like, okay, so you got this managed then. He's like, well, yeah, I think I pretty well got it managed. And he's like, okay, we'll skip ahead to step two for just a second. Do you believe that a higher power or a power greater than yourself can restore you to sanity? He's like, I don't know that I really am insane. Which I didn't really put two and two together. Crazy people don't know they're crazy. It took a little more pain. I had to thoroughly get that foot in my ass. So I went back out after, and it was in pure glorious alcoholic fashion, or average alcoholic fashion. The night before, we were going to have a meeting with a union rep and the store managers and the immediate supervisor, some guy from corporate that I'd never met. It's the night before that, a buddy of mine comes over, like, hey man, you want to hang out? I was like, I got this meeting thing I got to do tomorrow. I got to get my job back, you know? And he's like, okay, well, you don't want this then? Yes, I want that. And, he twisted my arm and got shit faced drunk, and me and him start doing our typical. You know, we would get drunk and fight. That's what we do. Like, not mean fight. Just like, I wonder if I can bust his lip. I wonder if I can make him tap out kind of fight. And Somehow or another, I wound up with a knee print on my forehead, which looks really good when you go into a meeting to state your case as to how you're getting better and how you're trying to turn your life around. Never mind the fact that I'm certain I smelled like a putrid still the next day. I didn't get that job back, and that was when I knew that God just didn't care about me now. It's all on me. And I'll get this, like, whatever. Like, he's drawn the blinds. He's not looking at this train wreck anymore. So I continue to drink like I drank. I actually got a job as a massage therapist for a while. I did go to school for that. Aced all the classes. You know, I was top of the class, drinking my ass off constantly. And never actually went and got certified for that, but still managed to land a job doing that. And made a little bit of money doing it, but, you know, if you want to see sexism in the workplace, be a male massage therapist. Also, if you want to not get any clients, smell like liquor every day. I gotta think that probably had an effect. But I came back into Alcoholics Anonymous after everything finally collapsed on me. I managed to get 7 months in this time, and I was feeling good. And I came up with another excuse and went back out, because that's what we do. We slip, we fall, and it hurts. And it was a minor slip. It only lasted about 2 years. I've heard of much worse. I survived it barely. By the end of that, I was not John anymore. I was just this gelatinous blob of flesh saturated with liquor. My eyes were turning yellow. I was a store manager somehow at Dollar General at this point, which that was my excuse then, because I was working 70 hours a week. I didn't have time for meetings. I had too much stress on me. I never had time to focus on me and to try to take care of what I needed to take care of. I had a sponsor that I hadn't talked to in sober in probably about a year. And I would call him drunk once in a while, and he would just kind of say, well, go to a meeting. You know what you're doing. You know you're killing yourself. And one day I come to work. I'm getting ready for an inventory. And it's about 10 o'clock in the morning. And I feel like hell. I had been there since 5 that morning, and by 10 o'clock, my district manager comes in to walk the store with me, because he wanted to just check up and make sure, because, you know, that I was his newest store manager, and, you know, I was working a high-shrink store, once again, one of my excuses, and I needed a drink. If you had my life, you would drink, too, and we come in, and we're walking the store. I'm about 3 minutes into walking the store, and he looks at me and says, John, have a long night out on the town last night? No, sir. Had a long night in with the missus. All right. Well, don't make me send you for a drug test. Started having flashbacks, because I know I can't quit drinking. It's impossible. I've tried everything in the world. I've tried AA, and I can't quit drinking. The only way I'm going to quit drinking is when I die. And not 20 minutes after my boss left, that sponsor who I hadn't spoken to at that point, I probably hadn't spoken to him in a couple of months, he comes walking through the door. And he comes through my line, and I tell him what just happened. And he's like, well, you got a nice boss. He shot a warning shot at you. Okay? Well, you know what you got to do, right? He's like, I got to quit drinking. Hell, John, we can't quit drinking. We cannot. We're alcoholics. We cannot quit drinking. The only thing that we can do is not start drinking today. And the only way I know to do that is to catch a meeting, dumbass. So he was a nice guy. He is a nice guy. But that didn't stop me from drinking, though. I kept right on drinking. I went home, and I got drunk and went to a meeting. I don't really suggest it. I mean, do what you got to do. It takes what it takes. I made it to enough meetings drunk that I knew that I was going to have to kill myself. Like, it wasn't taking for some reason. I was calling psychologists. I literally just about called every psychologist in the book in Cartersville. I need help. I need help. And I say, well, what's going on? Like, I can't quit drinking. I'm really depressed. I'm having suicidal thoughts, and they're borderlining on suicidal actions. I'm not about to hurt myself. I'm not about to harm myself. Don't send the police. But I'm doing some things that are red flags that I'm probably not going to be on this planet very much longer. And what can I do? You need to go to a meeting. You've been to AA before. It works. Are you serious? That doesn't work for me. I'm unique. I'm special. So I kept trying. I just kept coming back in, even though it was really uncomfortable. Because I knew that I didn't want to die. But I couldn't keep living like that. My eyes turning yellow. Literally, that bump right there would turn into a 2-week bruise that big. Like, it was bad. My liver was shutting down. I was getting pains. I was pointing out, like, oh, that's that organ. That's my kidneys. Those are aching today. Okay, that's not a good sign. Oh, there's that pancreas. About time for a drink. Okay, yeah, it's getting ready. It's getting prime, getting ready to metabolize all that liquor. Finally, one Friday night, it was August 17th of 2012, I went to the Sir Club, 6 o'clock meeting. There was nobody there. What the hell? Oh, yeah. They're doing the roundup this weekend. Forgot all about that. I'll go see what that looks like. And keep in mind, I'm drunk as hell, driving all around Cartersville, trying to get sober. I drive over to the Hilton Garden Inn, and there's barely a parking space anywhere. And I manage to finally find a place to park. I go in. I'm like, a $25, $30 cover charge? Like, what is that? But I was willing to do that much. It's like, you know what? What is that? That's one night of liquor for me. All right. We'll see what happens. $30. I got all weekend to try to see if maybe this time it'll be different. What I didn't realize was that it was 6 o'clock. It was, you know, the mid to late August in Georgia. And it's 2 hours until the speaker meeting starts up. And all the cool kids are hanging out outside smoking. And I'm one of the cool kids, so I go outside to smoke. And there's a lady, Beverly, I walked up to. She had seen me in the meetings, and we kind of talked a little bit after the meetings. And she told me, like, you got to not drink and go to meetings. Like, the first part I wasn't getting. The second part I was trying. I walk up to her, and her response was, oh, hey, God. and she says, let me introduce you to somebody. And she takes me over to this guy named Robert. That he's a talker. Anybody from Cartersville or the area, they know Robert. He used to work for the train people, and me and him got to talking out there in that summer heat, facing west as the sun's going down. I still remember it was terrible, and I'm sitting there just sweating all that vodka out, and I'm just not feeling this. It hurts. Like, I'm sitting there talking to him. I'm muscling through. I'm like, I'm gonna do it different this time. Just today, I'm gonna do it different. And I literally had started hearing myself say that. Just today, I'm gonna do it different. Just today, I'm gonna do it different. And we finally, the speaker meeting starts up. We go in and we sit down. I couldn't tell you who the speaker was. I remember there was some pretty funny stuff, but I made it about 20 minutes into his talk, and I knew I was about to vomit, so I didn't want to take away from the meeting, so I got up and left. I'm driving home, and I call Bob, my sponsor, and I say, hey, Bob. He's one of my sponsors. I had gotten another sponsor because Bob had fired me because I kept calling him drunk. But I called Bob because I knew that he was available, and I tell him, like, hey, man, I'm going to do it different tonight. I'm going to go home and pour out all my beer. He's like, don't go to your house. I'll come over there and I'll pour it out with you. And I'm there for you. And I said, I got it. I just need you to talk to me while I do this. And I go home and I pour the beer out. And I made it through those first 36 hours knowing that at any minute I could die. I had heart palpitations. I had a really, really solid detox experience. I never want to go through that again, and that's why I keep coming to meetings. What took me years to figure out is that we can only do this one day at a time. I kept trying to stay sober the rest of my life. Now I just go to bed sober every single night. I do what I got to do to stay sober every single night. I'm kind of not regretful, but I do wish that I had dug more into the fellowship of AA in the early years of my sobriety. I let my job and my career and things sort of dominate my time. I still did just what I needed to do to stay sober. I got by on what I called the bread and water ration as far as staying sober. I talked to an alcoholic every day, and I didn't drink. I read my book, and if I saw somebody working at the Public, I get to see drunk people all the time, and I can kind of let them know, like, oh, yeah, I used to drink like that. Yeah, I had to figure out some way to stop, and I would end it there. If they asked me, it's like, hey, I know some people. You can go over to Elizabeth Street. You know, you might just cruise by there about 6 o'clock at night. There's always somebody there. Getting into service work was something I did out of desperation. I felt a relapse coming in last September. And I'm not going to bore you with the details, but it was romance and finance. It will get you every time, and I knew that. And I got my ass into service work because I knew that if I'm in the middle of all this, if I got my hands full with all of this, somebody's going to need me to do something, and somebody is going to give me some reason to stay sober. Just curious, is there anybody in here that's got less than 30 days sobriety, continuous? I'm not trying to embarrass anyone. Thank y'all. Thank you. You guys are keeping me sober. That guy right there. Yeah, thank you. You guys are what keep me sober. The fact that we can all get better by helping someone else, that has saved my life again. And it will continue to save my life. As long as I'm willing to do that work, as long as I'm willing to put that in, I know that I could sit here and talk till 10 o'clock, and heck, I think I will. I'm starting to get comfortable now. I hope that anybody's gotten as much out of this as I've gotten out of talking tonight. I appreciate everyone that's here. And I'm really glad nobody kicked me out of the meetings for slurring my speech. Thank you all.